listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have a very talented producer, recording, and mixing engineer, Mr. Mike Daly. How are you, Mike?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. How you doing?
Good, man. I'm good. I just read in your bio, you're from Chicago, man. You're from Chi-town.
Yes, sir. I grew up in the city downtown.
So you must be a Cubs fan. You must be a Bulls fan. Oh, you're a White Sox fan?
White Sox. My dad's okay. From the South Side, and my grandma's from the South Side. I love the Cubs, though. I don't, like, hate the Cubs like some Sox fans do. And I feel like I go to more Cubs games. But yeah, all of my kind of gear and memorabilia is all kind of White Sox stuff at home.
I love Chicago, and we always fly in usually when we play Summerfest to Chicago and play a date in Chicago. So we played at Reggie's this time.
Oh, yeah.
Legendary. Do you know John Primer by chance? He's a Chicago bluesman.
I don't, but awesome. I've been to Reggie's a ton of times.
Yeah, so we had him sit in. He was one of Muddy Waters' last guitarists. Like, he's a very awesome old school blues guitarist. Next time you go back home, go see him because he's incredible. And I just stumbled into Chicago blues and he just happened to be playing, and that's how I met him. But I have so much love for Chicago. I have one Chicago question to ask you.
Yeah.
What's your deep dish? What's your choice for deep dish? Is it Lou Malnati's?
I like Lou Malnati's. There's actually this place that like my family grew up ordering called Bacino's.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite. It's like spinach deep dish.
Yeah.
So good. But there's like a Lou Malnati's near my house. So I feel like when either my wife's in town or we're like kind of have people in town, that's like an easy spot to bring people to.
I've been to the three, Gino's, Giordano's, and Lou Malnati's. And I still love Giordano's the most, but Lou Malnati's is like right there. They're like neck. And then Gino's is way below that.
That's funny.
So you came to LA and you studied at the LA Film School, the LA Recording School. Tell me what that experience was like. Were you already kind of like well-versed with recording and music? Like, what was the moment of Zen that made you want to, you know, pursue music and also wanted you to record and become a producer?
Yeah, actually, I was not. I was definitely in over my head. I had gone to college for 2 years and kind of just like partied way too much. I was not like ready to kind of be away from home and have responsibilities and everything. So I got like basically kicked out of college, moved back home, and was working for a while. And I went to college at University of Arizona. So I was like on the West Coast, and we were kind of like spent a spring break in LA, and a lot of my friends were from California. So in my head, I was trying to figure out how to get to LA. And I was like making beats on like Fruity Loops on my computer, but I had like a crack version. I couldn't like save any beat. I could just like, I'd work on it for a week and bounce it, and then would have to start like a new session.
Wow.
And I basically was like on the internet, and there was Full Sail, which was like super expensive and like a 2-year program. And Los Angeles Recording School had a kind of reasonable program, and it was only 9 months long. And they, at the time, they guaranteed you an internship, which was like part of their program. You actually needed the internship to graduate. So I kind of convinced my parents that I was like ready to, you know, take this serious, and I would be, you know, like, I'd like really take this serious if they could like kind of help me out. and that I would have 3 months to kind of try to get a job. And if it didn't work out, I'd come back home and, you know, be working in Chicago. And yeah, so I took school really seriously. I was like trying to sit in the front of class, which I like, you know, wow, was never comfortable doing before. And I was taking notes and, yeah, really kind of focused, and then kind of landed like a dream internship, and then just kind of worked my way up from there.
Who was the internship with?
The internship was with some producers called The Underdogs, who were kind of like a staple in LA. My first couple weeks there was like getting food for Chris Brown, wow, Britney Spears, Justin Timberlake. Like they were working with A-list artists and kind of had A-list producers and writers up there. And I had never seen that side of the industry. I was kind of making rap beats on my computer and trying to get, you know, like local artists to rap on my stuff. So this was like a kind of a whole new industry that I kind of like knew about from TV and magazines and stuff, but never saw it firsthand.
What was your kind of experience going through that? You must have been like, because you coming from Chicago, you're like, man, this is a little bit crazy, some of this, just because.
Oh yeah, yeah, I mean, it was awesome. Really crazy. In Chicago, I had worked at the Board of Trade and the Merck, which is, my dad was like a stockbroker. And the first kind of job I had there was doing some kind of like internship, like runner type of stuff.
Right.
Like getting these like rich guys food and kind of taking care of their errands and stuff. So I kind of knew how to do that and right, how to like, you know, not bother them and not get in their way. And, you know, just like, just be a good intern. I felt like, right away I was able to kind of connect with my bosses just in terms of like not annoying them and like right, doing a right, good job and kind of just going a little above and beyond everything they asked me for. So I felt like right away I was kind of like welcomed in, and they started firing some of the other interns right away and giving me more hours. And I was getting paid hourly at the time. That was like one of the few internships that you were getting paid the hour. So I just never left. I got there at like 11 in the morning and I'd leave at like 4 or 5 in the morning, wow, clock my hours in. And I was making some like decent money.
Right.
And then eventually, you know, that lasted for like 2 or 3 months. And eventually they were like, hey, like you're making more than our engineers and stuff up here. We got to put you on salary. We want you to be here working every day, but we can't like pay you hourly. You're making more than some of the staff. And then, yeah, that kind of like solidified me as being part of the team. And I was just kind of willing to do whatever. I, you know, engineered some days. I was assisting people, assisting mixers.
That's awesome they let you do that. You know, sometimes they don't let interns make that jump. You know what I mean? That's a hard transition.
Definitely. And it wasn't like it took a while for me to get to that point. And then a lot of the times it would be just like the engineers run in the bathroom, take over for a second while they're in the booth. And then I'm like super nervous, just like, you know, cutting a couple lines on the song, but eventually got used to that. And then the engineers up there were great. They kind of, if it was like a new writer or something, they'd be like, all right, you go in, you record this. I'm like right behind you if there's any issues. So it was like a gradual process. But yeah, a lot of things went right. One of my bosses went to Arizona. So we kind of connected on that.
He didn't get kicked out? He made it through?
I don't know if he knows I got kicked out, to be honest. I never got that far. I was just like, oh yeah, I went there.
That's part of growth. It's part of growth. Sometimes yeah, it's part of it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, there was so many. Frank Ocean was a writer up there when I started as an intern. Bruno Mars. There were a lot of James Fauntleroy, who's one of the best writers in the industry. There were a lot of people I was around, and I was just kind of soaking it all in.
That's amazing. And, you know, I met James Fauntleroy at an ASCAP expo because he works with my horn section, The Regiment. I don't know if The Regiment did the Regiment guys ever come in there? They play with Timberlake and James Fauntleroy a lot.
I don't know, but like low key when James and Justin got together, he kind of like, that was like his kind of graduation from the Underdogs, and he started doing the stuff with Justin and kind of left the Underdogs at that point.
Oh, okay, cool. That must have been a cool experience, just you seeing singers and performers kind of recording, just being in the, being a fly in the room and witnessing. What was one of the coolest things you experienced while you were doing that?
You know, I remember Lady Gaga coming up there before she was, I don't know if her name was Lady Gaga yet, but I don't think it was.
Oh, wow.
But, she auditioned for the Underdogs, and I wasn't like in the room. It was like in the main, like the, like where the piano and everything was. I was like in the, like kind of the studio room, cleaning up. I used to like overly clean, just like keep spraying stuff and wiping stuff down just to be in the studio with everyone.
Right.
And I remember her auditioning and playing the piano, and I think she had like her leg up on the piano, and like, and I remember her auditioning and just thinking that was crazy. And then a couple years later, she actually came, we moved studios and had like a lot more rooms. And she mixed part of her album at the studio and came in, and she had like her whole get up on and like a whole outfit and all this stuff. And I felt like in my mind, I was like, oh, she's kind of like, she came back to like stunt a little bit because they passed on her. They didn't end up signing her or anything then.
What was the reason? They just, because she didn't have all that flair, or was it just-
I really don't know. I don't know if it was a great audition or not. I didn't get to like hear it. I was kind of just like seeing it all. And I think, you know, like what she looks like, or what she like kind of looks like without like all her, when she's not in like Lady Gaga mode, I just don't know if she was able to like sell that she was going to be, you know, a superstar artist yet. And I think they were at a point where they were working with superstar artists, and I don't know if they were necessarily trying to find the next one so much as work with like established ones. But I don't know that for a fact. I just in my mind, kind of why it didn't work out.
No, it's funny. L.A. Reid was fired because he passed on Lady Gaga.
Yeah, I think everyone passed on Lady Gaga for a while.
Really weird how like she was able to leverage that into, I'm going to be this superstar. And my first, you know, like interaction, I never met her, but I took my mom to the Grammys when I got into the Recording Academy. And that was right when she broke. And she looked like an icicle just like walking through the Grammys. So you could always see where she was in the crowd. It was like kind of amazing. I was like, that is so smart, because just because everybody knows where you are at all times. And if you're breaking and you're in a room with superstars already, you're just making waves just by doing something as small as just being a fashionable icon like that, you know?
Yeah,
so it's interesting that you saw the, Clark Kent version and then the Superman version of Lady.
Yeah. And I mean, she kind of got the last laugh on everyone on that, I feel like.
That's cool. Very cool. And so then when did you kind of make that move into being more of an engineer working and more of a producer? Like, how did you make that transition?
Yeah. So I think first, because they had me kind of like, they had fired a lot of the interns and had me kind of working all day, every day doing the intern stuff, which was basically like cleaning the studio and going to get food for everyone. There wasn't like DoorDash and Postmates back then. So then I became like the studio manager, and I was kind of in charge of hiring interns and teaching them how to, you know, be good runners and interns and what, you know, the studio expected of them. And also at that time, we had an extra like studio room with the SSL in it. And the guys I worked for split up at this point. So I went with, Harvey Mason Jr. and Damon Thomas. Harvey's now like the CEO of the Grammys. So kind of
contact to have.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But so I stayed with him, and he kind of like took care of all of us that started at the first studio as we transitioned into moving into this new studio. Even though they were like still building it, there were days where we didn't need to come in. There wasn't anything to do. and I was still getting my salary and stuff. So it was, you know, always super grateful for that. But basically, we would rent the other room out. And a lot of different mixers came in there, which was like really cool for me because I was like studio manager, but also kind of in charge of taking care of everyone in that room, which made me like kind of like an assistant to the mixer. So Manny was in there a lot, mixing records that I got a bunch of credits on early on, just being his assistant, really his kind of assistant.
Manny American.
So it was cool. Like right away, we're working on big records. And then also Lady Gaga's mixer started mixing in there. So I got some credits on some Lady Gaga stuff.
That's cool.
By assisting him. And that was cool because I was like actually his assistant more so than Manny's kind of like second assistant. But I learned so much from both of them. What was
one of the biggest things you learned just from working or shadowing them?
I guess just the patience and professionalism you need as a mixer. It wasn't so much like techniques because a lot of stuff has changed. Like everything was on the board then. Everything was automated. And it used to take me like an hour to do a recall. We had these recall sheets and I'd have to like write every single button on the SSL and like write it out and then come in an hour early to lock everything in. Now there's so much in the box. You just kind of pull up the session and it is how you last left it. But yeah, really just kind of being a professional and being able to not take shortcuts and like really, really kind of just doing the right work first so that later on you're not like kind of scrambling because of some shortcuts you took, I feel like.
That's awesome. You know, that work ethic is so important, and I'm sure you see it in the newer engineers or the newer generations. They're full of shortcuts.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's like, wait a minute. No, this is not how I learned. You got to go the distance, do the thing, be prepared, go the extra mile, you know, to just make sure things sound as good as they can. They're as organized as they can be. They're as run professionally. So I love that. So did you start like recruiting indie artists or like start working with artists that you would see around town, or how did you get your name out there to kind of get people to call you in for mixing sessions? Was it through this group?
I feel like I never actually started mixing on my, like mixing full records on my own. I started engineering a lot, like doing a lot of vocal sessions so I was either kind of assisting these bigger mixers or recording vocals for people that were up at the Underdog Studios.
Makes sense.
I mixed some records for some rappers and stuff, but that was like a lot different than doing like these R&B sessions with 100 stacks of vocals. And a lot of the times it was just kind of like mixing the vocal on top of like the 2-track for a lot of the rap stuff I was doing.
Yeah, Major Studio says that all these rappers come in with like 2 tracks. They're using 2 tracks on the SSL or the API.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's it. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah. So I never really had clientele as a mixer, and the engineer clientele was more so the Underdog's clientele that I was just mixing or engineering. And eventually, they were like, I know you're making beats. Like they would see me kind of with some headphones on or whatever. And I started slipping some of my beats in to these folders that I was playing the guys. Cause sometimes the Underdogs would leave early or, you know, go out and they'd be like, all right, there's a session at 9:00. Here's what we want them to write to see if they like any of these. And not all the time did they like those folders. So, sometimes they'd be like, play it again. And they'd, you know, be like, all right, we'll write to that third one you played. But everyone was kind of wishing they had more ideas. And eventually they started writing to some of my tracks. And
cool. That must have been such a good feeling.
Yeah, it was an incredible feeling. It was felt like what I had been trying to get the entire time. And then kind of right away from them writing to my tracks, I got a cut on a Chris Brown album.
Wow.
And that like kind of, I went from like 0 to 100 as like a producer that was kind of like scared to play beats and didn't really have any placements at all, to being, that album was Grammy nominated and went platinum. And so right away I kind of had some like validity to my name, I feel like. And then from that point, I had the keys to the studio. I was opening it every day. I had like a room I could go record in, because I was usually engineering other people's songs. But from that point on, I kind of just started I'd engineer, but it would be to my tracks. And then, yeah, just kind of like wiggled my way into being signed as a producer up there. And at that point, I was just, you know, like full speed ahead. Like, I'm a music producer now, and I have kind of access to incredible writers, an incredible studio, and producers above me that could like place records for me. So kind of just dove headfirst into that.
That's awesome. I want to ask you an interesting question, because it's something I've been thinking about, like, now that I'm going to be 46 this month. So I always, like, you get nostalgic as you get older, you know, and some of those early openings, like those early breaks, were such a rush. And it's like, as you get more seasoned as a professional and as a veteran in this business, it's harder to get that same kind of rush from that first, you know what I mean? That first time where somebody's riding to one of your beats, you know, that feeling is like, holy shit, I like your cat. It's like, yeah, I'm gonna come in for this question. So do you feel like that, to get to that same rush, is harder work because you've been around a little bit more now, and it's like you're trying to find that same level of a high in this business?
Oh yeah, it's I don't think I've come close to having that feeling in a long time. It's almost like a relief now. When like I have a cut come out, I feel like there's a lot of people that a lot of writers I work with or producers I have kind of under me, where I feel like a responsibility to get these records and get these cuts, that it just feels like a relief now to get the record, be able to pay them. I feel like more so than any rush for me to be on records anymore. I still get like excited about certain things. There's still like goals or like little notches that I've like wanted for a while, and it's taken me a while to get. I had a couple this year that I'd wanted for a while, a couple artists specifically I'd been trying to work on for years. So those always feel good. But again, it's just like, I'm just so on to like, all right, got that. Now what's next? How do I get the next one? How do I keep paying people? How do I keep wanting people to work with me? So yeah, it's a little bit more of a relief than a big excitement these days.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because it's that's how it is for me too. It's like, for, I think there are certain little doors you go through, certain like rites of passage. Like for me, it was like the first time I played to 1,000 people, and then the first time I played to 10,000 people. And it's like, I hate that that is not as exciting the second, third, or fourth time.
Yeah.
Or like, you know what I mean? Or it's like, because you think like, oh my God, playing for 50 people was almost more of a rush than some of these later shows that you worked so hard for. So it's like, it's like this, it's like a desensitizing thing that I'm trying to understand, because it's like, you know, if anybody, and you know this, if any intern was in the situations that you're in now, their minds would be blown. Being able to work and operate like that. But it's like, we kind of like, as veterans in the industry, we get kind of desensitized. And it's like weird that we do, because it's just part of running the business. It's like making sure the wheels are turning, making sure the lights are on, you know? So I was just asking that because when you were talking about it, I was thinking about it. It's like, I've been thinking about this a lot. I always think about, I get reflective towards the end of the year. So
yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of things too. I think I'm kind of deep into the K-pop scene, and the numbers that they're putting up, the records that they're selling, are just like unreal, to the point where, and then everybody it's just become a thing. Like, you, everyone that's on the record is just posting the album sales all over their story. And every week you're seeing people post what records sold. And yeah, it's kind of super desensitized, just the whole aspect of getting a placement these days. And then, yeah, some of the numbers are so outlandish that, I mean, there's groups that could sell a million in a week, and that's like quarter. That's a quarter of what some of these other groups are doing in the first week.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, but well, yeah, there's.
Sorry, go ahead.
I remember getting Pinkberry for Britney Spears. That blew my mind for months. I was just thinking about how crazy that was. And then now, yeah, I'll be in the studio or run into whoever, and definitely just desensitized from a lot of the stuff that used to have me going crazy.
Is there any gear that you're still like, oh, I'd love to work on this Neve console or this? Is there any piece of gear that is still like, oh, I love working on this?
I think being around SSLs is like a nostalgic thing, because I just think about doing all these recalls and stuff.
Right.
But I work so much just on my laptop now. Yeah, it's kind of like just more of a nostalgic thing than me needing it or wanting to do it so bad.
It's weird because I do a ton of stuff in the box.
Yeah.
And I still do. Now I'm doing this like live recorded series, and we just do one day where we're in a studio, and it's like, man, this is what people used to do for months on.
Yeah.
There's just no need for it in the same way. So it's just weird because this gear is just sitting there not being used sometimes, and it's just crazy, you know?
Yeah. Did you learn how to cut tape and stuff?
I've actually recorded 3 or 4 records on tape. So there's a studio called Hard Drive Analog. I'll have to take you there sometime.
Yeah.
He's got the actual tape machine that Pink Floyd, The Wall, was recorded on.
Oh, my God.
Steely Dan Asia, overdubs were on that. And Fleetwood Mac Rumors was also mixed on it. It's called a Stevens tape machine. We recorded on tape. I never actually cut the tape because I was so nervous. I'm like, I don't know if I want to cut tape and then have to splash. We make a mistake. So we would either just do an overdub, or I'd rehearse the band so much that we'd get all the takes in, you know, just one take, you know, which was crazy to do.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Have you ever worked on tape at all?
I'm trying to remember if I ever worked on tape at Lars. I can't remember if there was a class or not. Like, I kind of have a memory of it, but I also could be like stories that were passed on to me that I've kind of turned into my own memory.
I kind of wanted the experience, you know, just because I just had heard so much about, you know, drums and things sounding bigger. And it is true. Like, I actually love recording the tape, and I've done a record as recently as like 2021 to tape. But when I've been going back to Pro Tools and Logic, it's like, oh yeah, this is so convenient. You have infinite tracks. With tape, you got 24 tracks or 16 depending on the speeds. But I just like that experience, so that like I can walk into any studio and just kind of understand both sides and understand why it's good to do one or the other, or using both. I just needed to, it's because it was such a mystery for me for so long. You know what I mean?
For sure.
So, but there's definitely intrigue. I still have moments where I'm like, man, this would be so great just record on tape. But let's play something of yours. Your choice. What do you want us to play first?
Let's play All the Way Home. That was like the first single I ever did, and my dad's favorite song I've done. So one that's always going to be special to me.
All right, here's All the Way Home. I'ma turn back. Ooh. Wait a minute, baby. Going too fast. I'ma turn back. Don't even know what we're fighting for. But damn, I need a minute. So baby, keep your distance. I heard it all, so I'ma just go. Don't bother waiting up. Great tune, solid mix, great vocals, just awesome arrangement. Tell me what your process was going through this, and what your experience was going through this. Is this Toni Braxton's sister?
Yes, it's Toni Braxton's sister. It's actually funny. The guy in that video is the guy who discovered Lady Gaga. She thanks him first Grammy. Like the only person she really thanked was him, Vince Herbert. But he played like a big part in my kind of getting from intern to studio manager, and then eventually working with his wife on that song with the Underdogs. He came to the studio, and I think it was a day. He was there for like a couple days in a row. I was taking care of him, running errands and getting him food. And there was a day that I didn't come. And some like other intern, a newer intern, was taking care of him and kind of messed some stuff up. And he basically threatened to stop coming to the studio unless I was up there taking care of him. And like, just like the way stuff ran when I worked there. And they basically pulled me in after that and told me that, and then kind of made me in charge of the interns and made me studio manager, and basically like, look, teach all the interns to do it how you've been doing it. So yeah, I'm always like super grateful to that guy.
That's cool.
For helping me. But yeah, that was like a co-production with the Underdogs. And I mainly did the drums on that song.
I loved them.
Thanks. I'm pretty sure they gave me the chords. And then I put some drums on it, and I think I recorded like the demo with a couple of my buddies.
Did you use multiple kicks, or did you just use one kick and you ran?
At that point I was like using multiple kicks and layering stuff. I'm sure I was like probably doing a little too much back then.
Oh, it's cool. I like it. I like big drums. That's the one
thing
I think a new R&B and hip hop is missing, you know? So
yeah. And well, I was chopping up loops and kind of placing drums all over the place. But yeah, that was the first like music video. Actually, I'm pretty sure that was the first like single or music video that I was kind of a part of. And that song was on like R&B radio, and I saw my name on Billboard for the first time. So it was like a big deal for me. And my dad loved it. So it was like a super memorable song for me.
Well, what's cool too, it's like, man, the Braxton sisters, they got some pipes.
Yeah.
You hear that ingredient in both their voices. And it's like, that's the crazy thing about the voice, where it's genetic, where I'm just like,
yeah,
you can't train that. Like I was, you know, I'm sure she's been in the shadow of Tony because Tony made it so big.
Yeah. But
she's every bit as good of a singer. And wow.
Yeah, she's incredible. She used to do a lot of backgrounds for a ton of artists up at our studio. And everyone always thought she had an incredible voice. I think she did a lot of Tony's backgrounds. And then Harvey used to be kind of like the diva guy. Like we did Jennifer Hudson, Toni Braxton, Anita Baker. Like there were so many big Leona Lewis. Like there are so many big powerhouse singers that came through. And a lot of the times it wouldn't even be a song that he had like done the track to. They were kind of paying him the vocal produce a lot of these artists on top of, you know, like write songs and produce for them.
But he's not a singer, right? I know he's a producer.
He actually has a duet with Toni Braxton. Wow.
Oh, I didn't know.
But it's like not, I don't think he's featured on it, but there's like a couple songs he's got like some backgrounds on and did some stuff. But yeah, there's one song in particular where I remember that I think he's got like a half of a verse or maybe a whole verse or the bridge or something where he's kind of going back and forth with Tony on the song.
Wow. I have to listen to that. That's
yeah. Great. He could sing. He's like an incredible vocal arranger, vocal producer. I think he's like one of the best at doing that. If not,
I just love that. Like he's head of the Grammys right now and the Recording Academy. And it's like getting a music person to be in that place is so key, because
yeah, for sure.
I did not like the guy before. I met him and he's just like he was such an old school, like sit on, you know, he kind of like made his way and then sat on the sidelines. And
yeah, no, it's cool. I think Harvey's doing a great job and kind of like bringing like what the Grammys is really about. Like it's not so much about just like you getting your award. Like they're really raising a ton of money to keep music in schools and so many other things that the award show is kind of, that's what it funds. So I know a lot of people like lose their mind about who didn't get nominated or who won this and that. But I think there's like a way bigger kind of picture behind what the Grammys is actually doing.
That's very true. Very true. Let's play something else. What do you want to play us next?
Let's play Boss. That was like my first big K-pop single.
All right, here's Boss. Like a world, it can get so good, baby. Shim, shim, I'm gonna get my gut and get my game.
Don't you know I'm a
내가 널 이끄는 대로 움직여 대충 모르 그 높이 너의 손을 뻗어 난 또 다른 너와 나를 묻지 또 다시 묶인 다른 우리 다른 우리 죽긴 너의 보스 내가 원해 가지고 싶다면 가져오는 선택 나도 너와 내가 시선을 맞추길 바라보지 man that's what I need you know me 나만 따라와 저 멀리 널 데리고는 겁 없이 더 큰 하나를 그리고 싶어 슬퍼졌어 yeah 모두 다시 태어난 것처럼 내 세계로 와 다들 물 만난 듯 노래
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm
내가 널 움직인 player
Don't you know I'm
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm Don't you know I'm Don't you know I'm
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm
내가 널 움직인 player
Don't you know I'm
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm Don't you know I'm Don't you know I'm
Just give it, give it, give it 기분 내킨 대로 좀 더 closer, closer, closer 믿고 다가서줘 이제 눈을 감아 앞에 펼쳐질 나의 세계 마음껏 들이셔 그대로 충분해 넌 아름다워
성급 소통이 더 팩대를 전대신 fly to you, die to you 직접 바꿔 make it, make it work for you
I became the boss for you
부질없는 post, no need
내가 나타내줄게를 알아 너야 feel now
Fear no
We are the eye I'm the bronze for the world, not a tear Yeah, how long I don't feel like I were lost Go down, gotta catch a lonely flight If you're better, 직접 다 가까 이건 다 right side
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm
내가 널 움직인 player
Don't you know I'm
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm Don't you know I'm Don't you know I'm
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm
내가 널 움직인 player
Don't you know I'm
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm
내가 너를 끌어봐
Don't you know I'm 돌이볼래 나의 노래
That was awesome, dude. That was a great beat. You made the beat. You did the. Tell me what you did for the song.
Yeah, I did the beat. It was at like the first K-pop camp I had in Seoul. So me and this guy Mitchell Owens, who's a producer I've been working with for the last decade or so, from Chicago. I brought him out and a couple writers, and yeah, that was like I had been going to Korea for a couple years with Harvey. And he had these camps, and then so that was like the first one of me leaving being signed to Harvey and doing like my own camp. So I was kind of nervous about it and really wanted to like perform and give them something that they could use. So that was like the beginning of me as like my own producer. So yeah, that one was like a big deal for me. It's so funny. I think K-pop's changed so much since that song came out. There's like a bridge and then an extra rap section and then an extra last rap section. There's just it's funny to listen to that.
Now it's like much simpler. It's like
yeah, it's a lot simpler now.
Yeah,
I think everyone's trying to kind of capture something that could be on U.S. radio now, so it's gotten a lot simplified.
I want to ask you, tell me what you think is the biggest difference between the U.S. market and the K-pop market.
Musically?
Yeah.
I think the sections, you know, there could be like a rap beat these days can go, it could be 8 bars for the whole song. The rapper kind of decides what the hook is and there's not too much movement, maybe some in and outs of some hats or not hats and stuff like that. But the main chunk of the beat usually goes throughout the whole song. In traditional K-pop, you're going to have some difference between the A part and B part of the first verse. That's going to be split into half. Then there's going to be a B section that's going to be a departure from the track, usually kind of R&B-ish, jazzy chords to give one of the members, whoever is kind of the best singer in the group, a moment. And then the hook.
She likes stripped down to on the drums, right?
Like, yeah, strip back. Yeah, kind of like a little R&B singer solo moment. And then the hook is, you know, beefed up, big performance part of the song where everyone kind of starts dancing and everything else. And then usually the second verse has to be a little different than the first verse. I feel like in the States, everything just kind of flies over. There has to be
I love variation in the second
verse. Right, there's going to be a little variation in the second verse. And then additionally with the second B section, some maybe build it up a little bit more from the first one. And then the bridge is going to be usually a complete departure from the hook and the verses. Could be something that works with the B section, but usually you want to make it feel like its own kind of section.
Right.
It could be like a dance break there. It could be a singing bridge. You kind of have to think about the members of the group and then give each member a little section where they can kind of have the
Make that request? Are they like, we want a dance break here?
Yeah, yep. They're very involved. The A&Rs out there are I don't know how to say it. I was about to say so much smarter, but that's not what I was trying to say. They just
they probably are with the numbers.
They have so much more musical training than US A&Rs. I think US A&Rs kind of are like, it needs to sound like more like a hit or
so true.
Or like it's gotta be harder here, or like just kind of
stupid
yeah, stuff like that, where they'll come in and get on the keyboard and be like, what if we went to this chord on the wow. bridge, or just like little things like that, or like, oh, I love this part, but what about like, what if the last melody did something different, and give a suggestion. That's one of the coolest parts of being in Korea with them, is the suggestions that they give really make the record better. And then that's all you really want from A&R, is like, look, I'm trying to deliver a record for you, but if all you could tell me is we want it to sound like a hit or make it harder or whatever, it's not giving me a ton to work with. But but they really know what they're looking for the groups, so their input is like a lot more valuable, especially when you're in Korea and they're kind of hands-on with you, like not like help making the beat, but definitely giving you pointers of what direction to go. And then, you know, sometimes you might make an R&B B section and they're like, no, I think this would be a cool part for the rapper. Let's just strip it back, but keeps the drums going, and maybe just 808 and drums in this part. And just like that information is like really key to actually getting on the album and making something that whole label actually wants. Instead,
it's so cool to see the crossover too, like,
yeah,
crossing over into the US market, it's so big, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think they're super influenced by a lot of the US songs. Originally, I think why they liked me at first was because I was doing Chris Brown stuff, and right. You know, I think whether you like Chris or not, he's still such a big, impactful artist.
Yeah, absolutely. He's still making bangers.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, let's play the last song. What do you want to play us last?
Last song is a song that came out this year on a group called Aespa, and I've been working on them for like 4 years, really trying to get one on their album. I actually did this song 4 years ago, and I've been waiting for it to come out. They wanted it. They bought the record. And I've just kind of been waiting for it to come out. They've done a couple of mini albums leading up to their first kind of official debut album. And then, yeah, it was part of the debut album, which has been winning a bunch of awards in Korea, sold 1 million the first week. So really big album out there that I was like, it was one of those things I was talking about earlier, that I don't get too excited about things anymore, but it was one that I had been working for a while and was really excited to kind of be a part of that album.
And what's the name of it?
It's called Mine.
Here's Mine.
Yeah, go up, she didn't good in ja. Mine. Do the umm, mock, go chat on na. Mine. Getting color, chat on fake. Boon into some hua. Chum chum, nice. I'm your body, do take.
빨리 온 밤이 숨 죽이는 다가와도 밀려온 전율 도망칠까 Who's there? Don't hate me 무너지는 세계 그 안에 갇힌 채 다른 나를 마주해 나를 뒤흔드는 공포심 너니까 맛봐도 서명이 점점 커져만가 내게 드리운 어두운 라임 이 악몽 같은 밤 이론 속에 갇혀 지옥 속에 서있는 난 깊이 빠져든 혼자 다시 깨어나도 금세 펼쳐질 듯 나를 덮치고 깨고 없이 지는 그림자 Mine 두려움은 먹고 자랐나 깨진 거울처럼 fake 우린 초상화 점점 날 삼켜버릴 듯해 뻔한 거짓과 비밀 Don't be wasting my time 날 짓눌러온 텅 빈 어두운 환상일 뿐 틈절 찾아봐 깨워내 emotion on the real 어느새 흐려지는 view 더 이상 one by my head 제대로 마주할래 두 눈을 떠 부딪힐 때 검은 그림자 안개가 돼 좀 멀어가는 날 부서지는 안무 무너지는 장면 깊은 숨을 뱉어봐 하얀 융이처럼 사라지는 공포 될 거 아닌걸 예고 없이 지는 그림자 Mine 두려움을 잊고 마주할 깨진 거울처럼 fake 뿐인 초상화 벗어나 오직 나를 위해 오직 나를 위해 It's all mine, know you want it like It's all mine It's all mine, know you wanna like mine It's all mine, know you wanna like 나로 자란다
Of bangers, that's a banger for sure, dude. That's a great song, man. Great tune.
Thank you, I appreciate it. There were some really two of my favorite writers on that one, Cole and Adrian. But yeah, they killed that one. I was excited about that.
Great melody, great production. Just, you know, I love all the things that you've showcased because it showcases such old productions, the beats, the melodies, the arrangements. They're all mixed well. It's just very, very, very professional. It's very cool.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Where can people find you if they want to find you online and hire you for writing sessions, producing sessions, mixing sessions, etc.?
Yep. My Instagram is Shy Mike, Chimike, Shy like Chicago. And I think my Twitter is Shy Mike too. I think it might have like a underscore at the end somehow. I tried to like change my Twitter and then I lost Shy Mike. Yeah, I know, but those are the ones I'm kind of mainly on. I've got like an email in my bio, I believe, so could either DM me or reach out on there. And I try to check everything all the time. So,
well, Mike, thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. It's such a pleasure to connect musically and just hear more of your story. We're going to have you back on about 9 or 10 months. I know you're going to have a bunch more releases. So just remember the songs. Remember the songs you played because we're going to have you back and we'd love to, you know, tell more of your story.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad we connected and I appreciate you asking me to be on this show. So thank you.
Of course,
so
we're going to have to collaborate musically too. On
definitely. Definitely. I'm excited about that.
Well, happy holidays on behalf of Mike, myself, and Sam. Happy holidays to all of you. We'll see you guys next week. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. Peace, love, and hate.
listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.